argument for today, Hannah David versus Gina Kaulu Kukui, case number 21-15731, and we will proceed with Mr. Foster.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity. If it pleases the court, I'm Charles Foster on behalf of Gina Kaulu Kukui, who is an employee of the County of Kauai. And this case comes from a denial of her motion to dismiss based on qualified immunity. And I think before this court is the question whether it's clear to a reasonable official that her conduct was unlawful in the situation she found herself. And put another way, whether pre-existing law provided her with the fair warning that her conduct was illegal. And I would assert that to this day, right now, it's not clear whether her conduct was illegal.
I want to ask you about the one that gives me the most pause in this case, which is, I guess I'm terming it the grab and go, where basically the defendant here went in after they got the court order and grabbed the child and took the child away from custody of the parent without any notification to the parent. I'm trying to understand how that would ever be thought reasonable. Maybe there is some circumstance, but that's the one that gives me the most pause here, where I really don't understand why, at least at this stage, your client would be entitled to qualified immunity in that context.
Well, I believe that that question takes us back to the complaint and the non-conclusory allegations therein. There's nothing in the complaint, there are no non-conclusory allegations in the complaint that would make Ms. Kaulu Kukui aware that that was occurring.
Counsel, you represent all the defendants, don't you?
No, Your Honor. I represent only Gina Kaulu Kukui. She's the only one who's moved, who moved for dismissal.
So the others are in the case, that's just, they haven't, they're not on appeal before us.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What's the relationship between William and Gina?
I'm not aware of any relationship prior to this between William and Gina Kaulu Kukui. She works for the police department. They might know each other. I'm not aware. Her job is essentially assisting victims of domestic abuse with resources, including assisting them in preparing and filing applications for protective orders.
So just so I understand your position, you don't read the complaint as having alleged that your client was involved in actually taking custody of the minor without notifying
the parent.
Yeah, the parent, Hannah David.
That's correct. I think that by the time we get into those facts, the complaint is just rife with conclusory statements about.
Okay, so let's
the
assume
parties
that
all being.
So I understand your position that the complaint doesn't allege that. Let's mm-hmm. assume we disagree with you, and that we
sure.
believe that the complaint does allege that your specific client here on appeal could have been or was involved. What's your position for why she would be entitled to qualified immunity by going to grab the child without any notification of
the
parent?
The TRO that was granted certainly doesn't require notification. I can imagine, in fact, that I would say that the statute wouldn't require that because one can imagine situations where it would be important to, you know, to secure the safety of a child without the offending parent knowing it was happening until after the fact. I'm not saying this is one of those situations. However, I would say that there is no legal requirement that that the plaintiff be forewarned. She was given notice, and there was a hearing, which under the statute is within 15 days, and that hearing
did
occur.
Wait, who was given notice? Hannah David was given notice?
Not prior to the seizure, but after the seizure, she was given notice.
Well, but that's sort of the issue here, it seems like. And maybe the facts will bear out, for your client, but based on the allegations of the complaint, can we just affirmatively say that there's no way that there was a violation of clearly established law here?
Well, I think that the standard is not that there's no way there was a violation of established law. I think the question is whether she had fair notice that there would be a violation. And there are, as I've argued, in the papers, no one has cited a case or a statute or any precedent that would put her on notice that anything that occurred was a violation of anyone's rights.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that and go back in time a little bit to talk about the TRO that got this whole thing going. Would you agree that if a government official knowingly withheld material information from a court in getting an order that would interfere with parental rights, that that would be clearly established violation of constitutional law?
Keying in on your phrase, material information, yes. In this case, as I've argued, there is no statutory requirement.
We're talking about constitutional law here, so I'm not sure that a statutory argument is going to save you, right? So, embedded that question with a lot of assumptions, and I understand you disagree with those, but I heard your answer to say, if what my question assumes is true, there's a clearly established violation. So it seems to me that the question here is, one, whether your client knowingly withheld information from the family law court or helped the father do so, and then two, whether that information was actually material. On the second part, I'm not sure based on the allegations that that's much of a question, because it seems like the family court indicated in later proceedings that had it known about a custody order, it would have done something different. So we'll set that one aside. Is your argument hinging on, with regard to the TRO, does your argument hinge on whether this plaintiff has plausibly alleged that your client knowingly withheld information from the family court?
That's certainly, that is one prong of my argument. It's a standalone prong.
And so if we disagree with your argument on that point, do you lose? And your client has to go to trial?
I don't believe so because because under the statute, and I do understand we're talking about constitutional law, but taking her, what is clear to her from precedent, from law, there is no requirement. And again, I'll back up and say one can imagine why there's no such requirement that a stipulated custody order is relevant to a TRO proceeding.
Well, hold on.
The parent...
Let me back you up on that one, because maybe that's true in a generic sense, but when the custody order here specifically said that the father could not file anything on behalf of the minor child, why wouldn't that be relevant when that's exactly what's happening here? Now, maybe there was an escape clause. I mean, there was sort of an escape clause for emergency circumstances. So
the health of the child.
Yeah, so maybe there was an escape clause, but to read the blanket prohibition that this couldn't be done, it seems like that would be material to a court to flesh out whether this was being done in violation of the prior custody order?
Well, the protect the family protective order statute here is, I guess in most states, is set up so that it can deal with exigencies. It can occur. It can facilitate a somewhat quick action for the benefit of a child. And then these things are necessarily fleshed out in a short amount of time in the return hearing, which is also required under the statute. And that is the time when all the different facts come together before the court, and the court makes its decision.
So you seem to be making the argument that the protective order just in no way could have been relevant to the initial TRO proceeding. It could have only been relevant after the child in a subsequent hearing. Is that your argument?
I believe that's how the statute is constructed. Yes, Your Honor.
So Gina, your client helped William prepare the application for the TRO, correct?
That's correct.
And did she make any effort to determine whether William had any custodial rights in the child?
It's not.
The answer is no.
Whether she did.
I know you're going to argue she wasn't required to, but the answer is no. Correct?
Certainly, under the.
When did she learn?
With the access plan, so yes.
When did she learn of the existence of the custody order?
Under the facts pled in the complaint, she could only have learned after she assisted him.
How is that true? I mean, I'm looking at paragraph 70 of the complaint. And the allegation in paragraph 70 is that the defendants had frequent direct contact with the father in the form of texts and emails and phones and in-person visits, in which they worked together at every step with the father to assist with and prepare documents that deliberately misled the family court.
Well, and I would first argue that that's entirely conclusory. It states factual conclusions without describing the factual support for those conclusions.
Which we must assume to be true for the purpose of this hearing, correct?
No, I disagree. Conclusory under Iqbal and Twombly, conclusory allegations are not assumed to be true. They're not given the assumption of truth.
So you think that she had to come in, that the plaintiff here had to come in with a specific text or a specific date and time of a conversation in order to support those allegations?
Your Honor, I'm terribly sorry. I lost
Let me repeat the question. I guess what I'm trying to understand is your position is under Iqbal and Twombly that the plaintiff here had to, instead of just pleading what Judge Forrest just read to you in paragraph 70, had to actually say on such and such a date, they had this specific conversation or there was this specific text. Is that your position, that this is like a fraud standard?
Your Honor, I would not say that it's that strict. However, what I would say is this complaint just alleged on unbelief this conclusory conclusion that they were all talking about.
Similar to about 80% of the complaints that are filed in federal court. I mean, presumably, are you suggesting that the plaintiff or plaintiff's counsel like violated the rules in making this conclusory statement, that they didn't do an investigation or have reason to believe that this statement was true?
Well, what I'm saying, and I would not disparage counsel. What I am saying is, it is insufficiently pleaded. If they had more information, that it should have gone into the complaint to give us some reason to believe that it's plausible that at every step of the way they were in contact with each other. That is just a naked statement. I mean, there would be, you know, in a 1983 conspiracy, then all one would have to do would say, well, I think they all were in cahoots, and that would be enough.
Well, you still have some defenses. They're going to have to prove this up, but I'm not. Anyway, we'll have to make the decision on whether we agree with your position on the pleading standards of the complaint. Yeah.
When did Gina learn of the existence of the custody order?
The earliest that anyone learns.
I'm asking about your client.
You mean away, coming away from the allegations in the complaint?
A very simple question, counsel. When did Gina first learn of the existence of the custody order?
She first learned of it after the PRO was prepared.
I'm looking for a date. Do we know a date when she learned?
I don't have a date before me, Your Honor.
It was after the grab and go.
I'm not certain it was after. No, I would say it was between her preparing the TRO application and the grab and go.
Between.
Sometime between, and I don't have a date. And I, you know, the focus of my argument has been on, because it, you know, it is a motion.
I understand the focus of your argument. Here's my last question.
Yes, sir.
Did she ever inform the family court that she? Was that there was a custody order and that it was inappropriate to prepare and file an application for a TRO neglecting this?
No. And I would assert that the reason is her job is to assist people in that come to her and say, I've been the victim of family abuse, and she assists them in filling out a TRO application. That's her job. Again, the system is set up in such a way that all these facts will come together, and at the return hearing within 15 days, which is what happened here. I would also say she didn't need to inform the court because the court was aware at that return hearing. The court became aware of that at that time. They were informed of that.
So is it fair to infer that she's never expressed remorse over this omission in the application for a TRO?
I don't know. I don't have those kinds of communications with her.
Okay. Thank you.
I have just one follow-up. I know we're running out of time, but I mean, it seems like you've got an uphill battle here because the arguments that you're making just sort of miss the human situation that's happening. I mean, this case is about, I think, an 11-year-old girl who's taken out of school by people she has no idea who they are and put in the custody of somebody who she hasn't had a relationship for 7 years. And the explanation is, you know, that's fine because we have a statute that allows us to do these things. I guess I'm just, the arguments that you're making today just seem to not recognize who was impacted by what happened here. It wasn't your client. It was this little girl.
Well, and I feel constrained by the complaint and how it's pled, but if we get away from the complaint, her attack on the father at the station was videotaped, and frankly, she's acting completely out of her mind. And also, not in the complaint, is Child Protective Services initiated this all occurred under the CPS statutes, and they did investigations of her and found for a while that they were concerned about her mental health and that the child was not safe with her. This is not pled, this is why I haven't argued it, but if we get outside of the complaint, there are many, many facts that—
And all that makes sense.
Yeah,
it
I know that
seems
the complaint—
like this case seems like, you know, needs to be tried, right? There's all kinds of facts and this is messy. Anyway.
Well, except that I think that the bottom line is that it is just not clear to a reasonable official that assisting with filling out a TRO petition without knowing all the facts was a violation of anyone's constitutional rights. And I mean, her assumption is the system is set up to deal to absorb those facts after the exigency of the danger to the child has been mitigated. And so I think that that's how the system is viewed, I would say, by an employee of the police states, police department, whose job is to assist victims of domestic abuse.
Okay, counsel, thank you. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
I thank you very much, Your Honor.
Yeah, we'll hear from Mr. Yolkin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Kevin Yolkin on behalf of the plaintiff appellee, Ms. Hannah David. I'd like to just answer a couple of the court's questions here, because I think the court certainly has hit this directly on the head. This case and the appellant's motion for qualified immunity at this stage is far premature, given the entire factual situation that's at hand here. At base, this case is not complicated, and at least for the purposes of this motion, the court's decision today is not complicated. The appellant's actions were unquestionably intentional in withholding material information.
Well, let's be clear what we're talking about. Clearly intentional as pled in the complaint. I think you've got a pretty good case on the complaint, but I am concerned about an argument that if it turns out that Gina did not know about the court order when the TRO was obtained, I'm not entirely sure that she wouldn't be entitled to qualified immunity if those facts bear out. So could you address that? You've alleged in the complaint, and that's what we're dealing with, that Gina knew about it before she went in to file for the TRO. But if it turns out that that fact was not true, do you think then Gina would be entitled to qualified immunity, at least as to obtaining the TRO in the first place?
The short answer, Your Honor, would be no, but I'll back up and explain. First off, to answer your colleague's questions about whether or not Ms. Kalakukui knew, I don't expect this court to have a handle on the very complicated procedural history of this case at this point, but this was an emergency situation where the plaintiff's daughter was ripped from her hands without any prior notice. She was taken to another island, placed with an estranged biological parent who had no relation to this child and from whom custody had been taken away by court order. No visitation, no custodial rights, and no legal rights. Now, we know because the father filed a counterclaim that Ms. Kalakukui knew prior to preparing the TRO that this custody order was in existence. I understand that's not pled in the complaint, but the complaint was filed in a rush of trying to obtain custody of this young child.
When you say that wasn't pled, courts. You mean that specific fact wasn't pled, not that, did plead that she knew before filing the TRO.
Yes, Your Honor, and the district court correctly found that that's easily inferred from the allegations in the complaint. But at the time, we did not know whether or not Ms. Kalakukui, the appellant, knew of the custody order. We know now that she did, and yet she withheld that information. We also know now that the custody order came to the attention of child welfare services workers prior to the seizure of the 11-year-old girl, yet nothing was done about that. And we do have text messages and communications and emails, but this case has been stymied for over 2 years now at this point, because the appellant has continued to file motions, continued to impede our ability to proceed and to get discovery on those types of issues. But the issue before the court now, the court has certainly asked pertinent questions about the constitutional right at issue. It's not looking at the legal rights of the biological father It's not looking at the state statutes that may or may not grant child welfare services to do certain acts. It's about the appellant and her actions that are alleged in the complaint. Causation is certainly satisfied. It is well established for purposes of a 1983 claim that causation is established by a person who sets in motion an action that leads to a constitutional violation. Unquestionably, that is what the appellant has done in this case, and she simply dismisses all of the allegations against her.
Counsel, you mentioned that some of these pleadings were put together in kind of a rushed fashion on behalf of your client. Aren't we dealing with the first amended complaint?
We are, Your Honor, and the first amended complaint was filed several months later. It was basically to include names of individuals who had changed. But as I stated before, we haven't been able to conduct...
The rush to, the understandable rush to return the child to her mother is not an excuse for any failings that might exist in the First Amendment complaint, correct?
No, I don't believe so, but I don't believe there are any shortcomings in the First Amendment complaint for the purpose of a motion to dismiss.
I understand your position, but you argued earlier to us that that rush was the reason the complaint is not more specific.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. We have not had an opportunity to conduct more in-depth discovery to provide additional allegations and to substantiate facts. As your colleague pointed out, there are a number of facts that are all over the place in this case that need to be fleshed out. The bottom line is the complaint is entitled to all reasonable inferences at this stage, and if it's given the presumption of truth, there is simply no question that Ms. Kalakukui's actions violated clearly established law. Due process rights require that a pre-deprivation hearing is held before a child can be taken from a parent. That is a fundamental, basic aspect of due process and custodial rights.
Counsel, with regard to this particular defendant, are you including here in terms of your claim based on the grab and go, we've been calling it, the taking of the child from school, are you including this defendant as part of that action, or are you focusing on this defendant with regard to the TRO?
Well, the principal focus, I think, for the purpose of this motion is the TRO, but the defendant was also an instrumental actor in the actual seizure and in the events that followed the seizure that prolonged the deprivation of Ms. David's constitutional right, and that's to the custody of her child. What happened was absolutely inexcusable, and counsel's arguments that were just made to the court are, frankly, they raise very serious concerns about a law enforcement officer who believes that it's just her duty to simply rubber stamp a very serious restraining order application that's going to take a child away from her custodial parent. Certainly, law enforcement officers have a far greater responsibility, and every reasonable law enforcement officer knows that they cannot deceive a court.
Let me ask you this. What if she was aware of the custody order, but thought and had reasonable belief that this fit within an exigent circumstance that was contained within the custody order, would your claim still stand that there was a constitutional violation here by not presenting that to the court?
Well, yes, and for two reasons. First of all, in an exigent circumstance situation, a post-deprivation hearing is required promptly. It's not based upon the statute of, it's not based upon the child welfare statutes of Hawaii. That's based on constitutional law. When a child is temporarily taken from their parents because a serious, imminent, an imminent threat to serious bodily injury occurs, that permits a temporary custodial deprivation. But post-hearing,
so your position, just make sure I understand it. Your position is, if Gina thought that that it did fit within an exigent circumstance and therefore was consistent with the consent or the order, the custody order, that she would have had to seek a return or hearing within sooner than 15 days. Is that your position?
Well, if the appellant thought that there were exigent circumstances, perhaps the situation may be different. But even so, Ninth Circuit precedent going back to as early as 1991 in Caldwell v. Lefevre clearly establishes that a parent has a due process right to a hearing when a child is removed and placed with an individual without legal custody. That did not happen here. There's no question that that due process hearing, which must be immediately after any deprivation occurs, did not happen in this case. There is also precedent from sister circuits, although I couldn't identify a specific case dealing with the exact issue at hand here.
Well, for qualified immunity, the sister circuits aren't quite as helpful. What, go back to that Ninth Circuit case that you were referencing. What was that case?
Caldwell v. Lefevre. That's L-E-F-A-V-E-R, 928 F-2nd 331. That case cites to several cases from the Tenth Circuit and from the Fourth Circuit where it's clearly established that it's unlawful to remove a child without a hearing prior. And specifically a Tenth Circuit case, Hollingsworth v. Hill, which the Ninth Circuit cites to, an officer serving a TRO should still give a parent opportunity to comply or have a hearing prior to just removing a child from custody. These are fundamental rights that to imagine the trauma that Ms. Davin and her child suffered from this incident is just incomprehensible to me. And that these state actors worked together from the very beginning up until the very end and then continued to grasp at straws to keep this child away from Ms. Davin is just
continuing to try and keep Ms. Davin from her child. That's been resolved now, right? The only claim here is that what's that?
It has been resolved now, but for a period of several weeks, almost 3.5 weeks, Ms. Davin was without her child. So, Your Honors, this case, as you pointed out, depends on many factual situations that haven't yet been borne out. Ms. Kalakukui is not entitled to qualified immunity at this early stage because every reasonable officer knows that her conduct at issue is unlawful. And I just want to briefly address some of the supplemental authorities that the appellant cited to. Understandably, the Supreme Court has been hesitant to accept qualified immunity in the types of cases that are a close call. And typically what we see is those are Fourth Amendment cases where there's a split-second decision, often involving the shooting of somebody, a life-or-death scenario. But this case is not analogous to that at all. These decisions made by various defendants at various times and the appellant throughout from start to finish were calculated, they were reasoned, and we would submit that they were intentional and malicious, which certainly overcomes qualified immunity. If Your Honors have no further questions, I will yield back.
Okay. We'll hear rebuttal. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I was just looking through Mr. Keahio Lalo's counterclaim. I don't see any allegations whatsoever that he told Gina about any stipulation in that counterclaim. Your Honors pointed out that the complaint was not hastily pled. In fact, it was dismissed at one point against it. And there was another motion, their proposed amended complaint, and several counts against Gina were dismissed at that stage too. So when they say, you know, we've been stymieing this whole thing, the only motion, in fact, that I lost is the one we're here on.
Counsel, we've been talking about a lot of different things as part of this argument. I want to kind of come back to what I think for me is the key and get your response one more time. I think that the key to this case is whether there is a plausible allegation in this complaint that your client knew about the custody order before she helped the father get the TRO. So I guess I have a two-part question. Do you agree that that's the key to the resolution of this appeal or not?
I don't think so, and the reason is, I think that, you were talking about using the term exigencies, and I think that's misplaced here as well. Again, the purpose of the Child Protective Services Act, and let me back up and say, you know, when we talk about that the child was still kept from the mother for X number of weeks, that's because the child was in the CPS system. And the mother was going to hearings, and there was a family plan in place, and she had to do certain things in order to satisfy the court that she was fit to have custody of her child. Her child was taken away from the father, but she was then placed in other foster care. And then she was with people who weren't her family at all.
So, because I'm not quite sure I understand your answer, but I think that this must be it. The answer is, it doesn't matter if she knew about the custody order before, because even if she did, the circumstances justified her going into the family court and helping the father get the TRO without regard to the custody order and without regard to telling the family court that it existed.
Right. Well, yes, and she did not go into the court.
So your answer is yes.
Yeah, I would say that is my argument.
All right.
That is my argument.
Okay. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments in this case. It's submitted, and that concludes arguments for today, and the court will be in recess.
Thank you.
All rise. For this session stands adjourned. Thank you.